Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and happy Friday, everybody. This is the Friday that is colloquially known as Black Friday, because, you know, it's the big shopping day where all the stores get their books in the black by selling a bunch of shit. And if you're lucky, you get a really good deal on something to give to somebody. But I think that for me, I've developed a good deal of perspective on holidays in general. Because here's the thing. I'm sure that there's something, you know, horribly racist at the root of Thanksgiving. But if you choose to celebrate the concept of trying to figure out what you're thankful for. Because everybody's got something to be thankful for. It's not a matter of trying to figure out what in your life is going wrong, because that part is easy, and there's going to be plenty of time for that. In fact, most of the time you're probably going to do that, whether you want to or not. But the idea of being able to take stock in everything that is currently functioning correctly. You know, maybe you've got all your fingers and toes, and that's all you got, and a pair of pants, and a shopping cart. Maybe that's where you're at in life. I don't know, but I hope that that brings you some kind of comfort, because there's something you can do with that. It's more than nothing. And this whole thing with, gift giving and buying things for other people, there's some value in that for sure, but I also think that it can be really vacant and just an easier way to communicate some level of affection towards someone than a conversation. Because let's face it, conversations are hard. I mean, how do you have a conversation with somebody that is going to be difficult and complicated and might involve, you know, some yelling, and then you have to come back later when you're calmer and apologize for the way that you were so out of sorts at the beginning of all that. To be able to tell somebody, I don't know how to express myself very well, but I do listen to you. And I know that you had your eye on that coat for a while, and so I bought you this coat as a way of letting you know that even though I'm bad at articulating it, I see you. I know you. And that's a net positive, I think. Am I way off base on that? Is that way too optimistic of a thought? That's really where I come from on all of this. Today on the show, we have got Katie Johnson. You probably are familiar with her band Television Generation, of which she is the bassist. And she's really a great artist as well. If you get a chance, I recommend you check out her art at Static Interstate Designs. And you can find that on the Facebook and on the Instagram. And I recommend that you definitely do that. And also check out Television Generation. They are just an awesome kick-your-fucking-teeth-in rock band. Really good. And the conversation we have today really revolves quite a bit around not really necessarily knowing where everything is going to shake out and how it's all going to land, but hoping for the best. Anyway, it's a beautiful conversation, so let's get into it right now. This is my talk with Katie Johnson. because I know that you guys have been doing this thing where you seem to be with the band recording individual songs just as they come. Like, so what's up with that?
That's pretty much been the process, because Will realized that he kind of has a huge backlog of songs that he wrote recently, and so we're kind of trying to go through each one as a band and play with them and see if they work, like, for our kind of sound, and if they do, then we'll go and record one, and then it's just like a matter of kind of choosing the ones that fit best together. We're currently trying to come out with like a full-length album, but it's been weird, like, kind of picking and choosing some of the songs that Will writes to make it like a cohesive kind of thing. And then I've got like a couple of songs that we've recorded that are going to be thrown on there. I don't particularly think that my songwriting is like, it's, this is like Will's like way up there, and like I'm like a little beginner person, but you know, it's still kind of cool to like hear what you've created kind of come together and become something.
Well, plus other people put their fingerprints on it.
Yeah, that too.
I always felt that way too. Like whenever I would join a band, I always wanted to write songs, but, you know, I would see people painting these Rembrandts, and then I would show up with, like, a Denny's placemat and some crayons and go, this is my song.
That's pretty much what I feel like right now, but it's nice that I'm, like, with a band where, you know, we all sit down and we listen to everyone's, like, ideas, and, you know, there's no, like, just discounting someone, like, throwing whatever they had to say, like, away.
Yeah.
You know, we consider, like, everything, so... It's a good work environment, I guess, as far as a band goes.
Yeah, it sounds like it's sort of a gentle dictatorship.
Yeah, where, you know, exactly.
Will is kind of at the head of things, and everybody benefits.
He's the gentlest of all dictators.
Yes. So let's take this all the way back to the all the way, because I know that you weren't born in Denver.
No.
And I know that you've got kind of a unusual lineage in that regard. Where are you from?
So I'm from Saipan, which I guess for the listeners is an island basically in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's much closer to Japan and the Philippines and everything like that than it is to the United States. Like, honestly, it's like Colorado's on one side of the world and Saipan's literally on the other side. and it's like this tiny little place. It's about 15 miles long by 5 miles wide. There's about 60,000 people that live there. But I was born there, and my mom's family actually comes from there, at least on her mom's side. So, it was an interesting growing up experience, to say the least. I'd actually kind of... I'd compare it, honestly, to growing up in a small town, because there was a lot of stuff that we didn't have, but it's, like, honestly taking that to a whole new level, because you can't drive anywhere else. There's no easy way off. You either have to get on a boat and sit on it for, like, the longest time, or you have to pay a whole bunch of money to get an airplane ticket to, like, go to civilization, essentially.
Yeah.
It was really weird.
How old were you when you left?
I was 17. I left to go to college, which was kind of a thing there. It was like you leave to join the military or you leave to go to college, essentially. And there's really no other way off the island. So I decided, I went the college route mainly because I came from like a privileged family, and I'm just going to say that right here because, you know, I'm not going to go and like pretend like I had this like horrible growing up experience or anything. And like, quite honestly, if you really think about it, growing up in a place like that, it really gives you like a whole new perspective on the world. So there was a lot of good things that went along with it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, after a while, I really just wanted to get off the island and like see more.
Sure.
Where was I at? I came from a privileged family on island, so I ended up going, I went to a private school all the way through like middle school, high school, and everything like that. And based on that existence, like everyone I was surrounded by was basically trying, their entire goal in life was to get into some kind of Ivy League school or something like that. I decided to go to CU Boulder because we had gone to Colorado more often than any other places in the continental U.S., mm-hmm. and I was just more familiar with Boulder than anything else. And like I said, it was kind of my out, so that's kind of how I ended up here.
Yeah. I mean, but you had lived your whole life up to that point. I mean, 17 is, I mean, your personality is formed at that point.
Yeah.
What was the governing country of, like, who were the parents of Saipan?
It's basically just the United States. We're a Commonwealth of the U.S. Yeah, so everything's completely American there. We use American money.
Yeah.
Almost everyone speaks English. Everyone who's born there is an American citizen. Unless, you know, our commander-in-chief has his way.
But, yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's all completely American. It's just that there's, like, a lot of other people from Asian countries and everything who live there. So
right.
There's a really
because
big...
Because of proximity, I would mm-hmm. imagine.
Yeah, so there's a really big Asian influence, like, as far as the culture goes. And, I mean, I got to meet so many different people from so many different backgrounds. And for that, at least, like, I'm really grateful. But, again, it did get very stifling after a while. Like, my graduating class in high school had 5 people in it, including me, and all 5 of these people I had gone to school with since I was like 10.
Yeah.
So it was really hard to find different people who I would kind of connect with because I'm more of like an artsy music kind of person, whereas on Saipan there weren't a whole lot of outlets for those kind of things.
Well, it doesn't sound like there were a lot of outlets for
very much
anything.
Of anything. Yeah, it was like if you did sports and if you liked doing like outdoorsy things and stuff like that, it was a perfect place for you.
Yeah.
But I'm totally not like that, and I never have been. So I was a little bit out of my element growing up there. At least after a while, when I started realizing who I am and what I enjoy doing and everything
like
that. Yeah,
and you had to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that strikes me about that is that it wasn't until I had actually gone anywhere that I started to really think about what, like, island life might have to be like for people. Because, I mean, being raised here in America, I think that most of us have this idea that, oh, the islands are places you go on vacation, and everybody's always sipping weird drinks and, you know, living laid back. But in reality, from what I've seen in the little bit that I've gotten to go around the world, is that it's isolating. And it's almost like there's touristy stuff at the edges, because how could there not be?
Mm-hmm.
But then when you get into the guts, it's like you said, it's like a small town where maybe there's a factory where that's the job.
Yeah.
There's like a good job. And and then there's just all these other things. And it's just island life. You brace for whatever your weather is. You're either going to be dealing with tsunamis, or you're going to be dealing with, 40 below weather because of the snow, like in Maine, you mm-hmm. know, those people are on another planet.
Yeah.
it's that kind of thing. I think that shapes people in ways that we don't really talk about. And before I met you, I'd never heard of Saipan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many people have. So I find that endlessly fascinating.
Yeah, it's not many people I've met around here know where it is, but then I meet like the select person. So I've, instead of being like, oh, I come from Saipan, which is a tiny island in the Pacific, I kind of changed it to like, oh, I come from Saipan, which, if you've never heard of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because some people get really offended or something when I act like I'm, you know, trying to
it's like you've got
educate
a,
them about
a note
something.
Card in your back pocket.
Yeah.
Saipan's main exports are...
Speaking of the weather, though, so Saipan and the surrounding islands, the actual island chain is called the Northern Mariana Islands,
mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the Commonwealth that's a part of the United States, but apparently the second biggest storm to ever hit the United States just hit Saipan at the end of October.
Oh, no.
It just decimated the entire place. Like, I saw pictures of my old high school, and there were, like, windows just knocked out. All the classrooms were flooded, and there was just debris everywhere. So many people lost their houses, and apparently one person actually died during the storm due to all of the debris flying around and everything like that. So there are a lot of people there who are really down and out right now, and it's gotten almost no news coverage in the United States.
Yeah.
At least from what I've seen. I think I saw, like, a Washington Post article go up about that, but, yeah, that's one of the things, though, is that it is so isolated that when something like that happens, a lot of the people out there really are on their own for a long time before anyone else can really get to them to help out. So, whenever something like that happens, like, if anything, it's kind of made the island into more of a cohesive community, because storms like that do happen, like, once every couple of years or so.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not like that, but, like, we get typhoons quite a bit. And so every time this happens, the entire community kind of comes together and helps each other rebuild and everything.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a weird, it's a weird, like, balance, I guess, of having a very strong community while at the same time also being completely isolated from everyone else.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you learn how to take the good with the bad, and you also learn, growing up in a place like that, you really learn how to do without. That's one of the things. Like, I grew up with rolling blackouts on the island for the longest time. When I think it was about, like, when I first went into high school, the power company, like, lost all of its money, and so they had to start shutting people's power off for, like, a certain amount of time during the day, and ours would get shut off, like, at 2 a.m. or something like that for a while. I would always wake up just, like, sweating because, like, our air conditioners had shut off in the middle of the night. So that was really strange.
Yeah.
Something like, I don't know, I come here and I remember there was, like, a really big windstorm the very first year that I was in college, and the power went off for maybe a total of 10 minutes. The entire CU Boulder campus was just freaking out. They did not know what to do. And I was just thinking, like, you know, power being off for, like, 2-3 days in a row is normal for me. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's something so very interesting about that mindset that comes from living in an area that's so isolated and yet is part of the United States that has to, or at least rather, I mean, you're American citizens, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
So to be American citizens and look at America, you know, the fat version, you know, the belt buckle version, the don't teach me science version, you know, from the outside and see that and go, yeah, they all have that. And they're just beating the shit out of each other. And here we are, you know, we are fighting this storm. It's got to feel, I mean, similar to Puerto Rico, I guess, in a lot of ways.
Yeah, sometimes I do find myself looking at a lot of people and what they complain about on, you know, social media on the daily, and I'm kind of like, is that really something to complain about?
Yeah.
Like, you know, you had to wait, like, 30 minutes or something to get a sandwich.
Yeah.
Come on, like.
I mean, there's something to be said about an individual's pain and suffering is hard to quantify because you can only measure it against what their level of comfort usually is.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, I do think that there are a lot of people that don't have their head firmly attached to their shoulders and able to see the reality around them of other people. And it may be a lack of empathy. It's really tough to say exactly what's causing it.
Yeah.
I always think it's lack of empathy.
I kind of feel the same way. I like to not really generalize, you know, how people act based on where they're from or anything like that. But I do seem to notice that there is, like, a real general lack of empathy amongst, like, a lot of people that I've met in the mainland. And I kind of think that, I mean, we might get back, get into this later, but I really think that, like, the fact that this system is so capitalistic and everything, it kind of forces people to really just start thinking about themselves all the time. So they get so wrapped up in their own world that they forget that there are other people out there who are experiencing just as bad or maybe worse things.
Yeah.
So I hope for the best. I tend to be much more of a positive person than I probably let on. but yeah, I hope the best for the future. And this is coming from someone who is mostly concerned about the environment and has been following all of these global warming things for the longest time, so.
It's a little intense.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at everything, and especially, I mean, of course you're aware of these things. I mean, you grew up in a place that was heavily affected by weather and climate, which are two different things, but they're connected. Weather and climate are connected. They're not the same thing, but they're connected. I would have to imagine that you've seen changes in those things in your lifetime.
Yeah.
I've seen the changes in Colorado in just the past 6 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I first came to Boulder for college, so it would have been, 10 years ago or so.
Yeah.
I remember that it would start snowing, like, sometime late in November, and there would pretty much be snow on the ground, like, at least in little patches and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, all the way through, like, at least March, and now you don't see that anymore.
Right.
In fact, like, it doesn't even snow, like, more than 3 or 4 times during the winter anymore.
Yeah.
So
we'll get one bad storm in March.
Yeah. It's like, I've even just noticed that in just 10 years of being here. And
yeah.
That's kind of crazy.
So, let me ask you this, to throw a complete curveball at all of this. When did you discover the bass guitar?
I started teaching myself how to play when I was about 15 years old. So this would have been back in 2005 or so. I decided that I wanted to learn the bass guitar after I found Sonic Youth, and Kim Gordon was, like, the most amazing person ever to me at the time.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like, I want to be just like her, and I want to play the bass guitar. So my parents bought me one, for my birthday Christmas present. My birthday's, like, less than a month away from Christmas, so I had a lot of those. birthday/Christmas presents.
Score!
Yeah, exactly. But that was probably the best present that I've ever gotten. I still play the same bass. It was a Fender Mustang, and it's my baby. It's a nice little short scale, so I can actually fit it. I'm, like, 5 feet tall for the listeners.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't know, I got into playing it, and I learned how to play, like, a bunch of Clash bass lines and stuff, but I realized after a while I was still on Saipan, and there was no one around who played music.
Yeah.
So I didn't have, like, anyone else to play with. There wasn't any, like, prospect of me forming a band or anything like that. So after maybe about 1 or 2 years, I kind of set it down and started focusing more on, like, visual art, which was kind of, it's always been, like, kind of my main thing. Ever since I was, like, a little kid, so, yeah.
But now you're playing in Television Generation.
Yeah, so that's been a really cool experience.
So, how did that come about? Because before you were the bassist, there was another guy, right?
Yeah, their old bassist, like, he was not a bad bassist by any means. He, like, played really well, you know, they'd had solid shows and everything before I joined. Basically what just happened with him was that he wasn't able to make practice a lot. He had a lot of other things going on in his life, and Will wanted to start playing more shows, and, you know, getting the band out there and everything. So we kind of were talking about this, and I was kind of like, oh, well, I play bass. Like, why don't I just try to play some of your songs, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
So the next time Anthony, our drummer, came over for just their regular practice, they had me on bass instead of their old bassist, and everything just seemed to work out really well, and we just kind of went from there.
Yeah.
For a while, the old bassist was playing rhythm guitar, but I guess he didn't really like having that role in the band, so...
Yeah.
We ended up parting ways with him, but it wasn't, like, anything bad at all. It was just kind of a mutual decision.
So, yeah, sometimes things just don't work out.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be anybody's fault. It's just part of growth and change.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of change and growth, what was, you had mentioned something earlier that intrigued me, and that was you were talking about having this discovery when you moved away to here, as a lot of people discover a lot of things about themselves, was moving away in college when you discovered depression?
No, actually, that kind of happened a little bit before I left for college. I actually remember the day that I kind of realized that there wasn't something quite right going on with my mind.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't really say, like, I've never been actually diagnosed with depression or anxiety or anything like that. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder in college, but that was a crap diagnosis.
Yeah.
Because I'd been drinking a lot at the time, and basically I was just trying to come up with, like, an excuse for my erratic behavior that wasn't me going in and being like, I can't stop drinking, there's something wrong,
yeah,
please help, you know, because I didn't want to admit to that.
Yeah.
So they ended up diagnosing me with bipolar disorder, which I don't think I have at all. But to go back to the beginning, I remember, like, the actual day that I realized there wasn't something right was, I'd been getting into music, and this is kind of an important part of the story. I'd been getting into the music for, like, the first time in my life ever, like, a couple of years before then when I was, like, 13 or so.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends had started listening to this great band called Blink 182, and I heard this great song called I Miss You, and I was like, oh, I kind of want to hear more from this band. So it was the first band that I really started, like, looking up and listening to albums by and everything like that. And for some reason, Blink 182 and Green Day and all these pop punk bands somehow led me into listening to The Cure. And the very first Cure song I ever heard was Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah.
And for some reason, that song just, like, hit me. Like, it was just an emotional punch in the gut. And I remember the first time that I heard it, I could not stop crying. And I just kept listening to it and listening to it and listening to it. And my dad was driving us to school one day, and I was listening to the song in my headphones, just kind of, like, trying to ignore the rest of my family and the world in general. And I just, like, started bawling, and I couldn't stop. And, like, there were just all these bad thoughts in my mind. And by the time I got to school, like, I realized I couldn't go through the day. And so my dad had to bring me back home. And I spent the entire day just kind of thinking, like, what is wrong with me? Like, this is,
yeah,
it's just a song, like, you know, and that kind of, like, led me down kind of a dark path for a while. I would listen to, like, the most depressing music that I could find. I got really into screamo music for a while. I spent a lot of time in my room listening to Disintegration.
Oh, yeah.
You know, just little candles lit. It's kind of, yep, like, you know, sobbing in the dark and all that.
Oh, totally.
And the weirdest thing is that I just didn't even feel like there was much of a reason for it, other than at that point in my life, I kind of started feeling more isolated. As I got further on, like, going to high school and everything, like, there were fewer and fewer people in my class. I started realizing that these people I grew up with, I didn't really mesh with, like, on a personal level at all. And there wasn't anyone, like, around who I could talk to about art and music and those things that I was interested in. So I guess I kind of started feeling, like, really alone and isolated at that point in time. And so, of course, you know, what happens when you know you're not in the right mindset is that you end up just isolating yourself more,
yeah,
when you feel that way, which,
right,
is exactly what I did. So there was all of that. I think that also, like I had mentioned before, like, I've always had, like, a lot of pressure coming from my parents about trying to be the best person that I could be. But it kind of started culminating to the point where, instead of really being an outward thing coming from my parents, it started being something that came from inside of me. And I started feeling like every single aspect in my life, from, like, my weight to my appearance to everything else, not just school, it was, like, something that I could improve on, and that I was not, like, ever going to be the best person that I was going to be unless, like, I focused on all of these things, like, constantly. And I don't know. It's, like, at that point in my life, I think I started creating this perfect version of myself. And it's not something, like, recently I've just realized it's not something that I'm ever going to attain. And ultimately, I feel like my main issue is just perfectionism. and the fact that, like, I mean, which is a weird thing to say because, like, people think perfectionism, oh, well, that's a great, like, trait to have. You want to just be better all the time. But the thing is, if you're trying to be better all the time in order to get to this, like, godly version of yourself, yeah. you're never going to get there. And whenever you fail, it just starts, you start, like, hitting, you put yourself down, like, harder and harder, like, the more you realize you're failing.
Yeah.
To the point where you just stop trying after a while. And I started noticing that about my art in high school because at that point in time, I had been getting into trying to, like, draw more realistically, and I was learning anatomy and stuff like that. But I never felt like anything that I created was ever quite right. Like, I could find, like, the littlest, like, piece of, like, any drawing or painting that I did, and I would just stare at that, like, one little error the entire time, and I would just... The more you stare at it, the more you think that, like, the entire thing itself is just crap.
Yeah.
And then because you were the one that made it, you think that you're crap. And
completely.
You're kind of like, well, why should I even try anymore? Because everything that I do is going to have, like, one mistake. So you just kind of give up. And if you're me, you start drowning everything in alcohol.
I think that's if you're a lot of people.
Yeah.
It's an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, especially since it... I mean, all it does is, I mean, drowning is a great way to put it, but, I mean, it wakes up the next day, and then you hate that, too.
Yeah, and it's, like, the worst, it's not a solution is the thing, because it's, like, you want to ignore...
Well, scientifically, it
yeah.
is.
Yeah, it's true, alcohol is a solution, technically, but, like... You know, you think that you didn't do something perfect, so you beat yourself up and you start drinking.
Yeah.
And when you start drinking and you get to, like, a point of being, like, way too drunk to even, like, be functioning anymore, you start making way more mistakes than you would normally.
Yeah.
And you just become, like, this nasty person. And so then you wake up the next day with a clear head and you think about all these terrible things that you did while you were drunk. And suddenly that brings you down, like, another peg. And so... Like, for me, whenever that happens, and I'm sure it's the same for anyone else who has alcohol issues, that'll put you in, like, a really deep depression that's so hard to claw out of, because you keep trying to fix it by drinking more, and the cycle
yeah.
just continues, so...
Well, and I don't know what your experience with this is, but I can tell you that when I was definitely drinking as a problem... My whole thing was, it was a way of controlling a lot of things. It, you know, much like the perfection that you're constantly striving for and not able to attain with alcohol, there is a point A and point B, and you can attain drunkenness.
Yeah.
And you can be sloppy, and you can be out of sorts, and if you are over-emotional and crying, then you've done your job. Or if you are out of control and happy but a little stupid, you've done your job. There's all of these archetypes that you can look at very easily, and it's very easy to get there, because all you have to do is swallow a liquid, which... You have to do to stay alive anyway, so you're good at it. And it's a way, it's almost like there's a control element to it. Everything else is chaos and you can't achieve. And then here's alcohol helping you achieve something.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I've noticed about myself too, is it's not just alcohol, but I'll find other, like, control mechanisms when I start feeling like my life is spiraling out of, it's just going crazy. I got to the point with drinking where I was basically remaining drunk for, like, 2 to 4 days at a time. And, like, I would wake up and, like, I would drink, like, a bottle of wine for breakfast, and I would just keep going and going and going. And there are, like, days of my life that I just lost. And after waking up from one of these benders, I decided enough is enough. I poured all of my stash down the drain. I remember, like, I chugged one last beer to stop the shaking, and I was like, all right, I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
And I quit drinking for 2 years, but during that 2 years, I found other control mechanisms to make my life still feel like it was in order. So I started, I basically fell back into, like, what I had issues with in high school, which was my weight. So I started restricting food. I started, like, having this extremely strict exercise regimen, where it felt like if I didn't do the thing that I was supposed to do that one day, then everything should just be thrown out of the window and I need to give up and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that was how I was in high school too. Like I had this idea in my mind, I had to run. I still remember my stupid schedule. I had to run 3 miles every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I had to run 5 miles on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I had to run 10 miles on Saturdays and Sundays.
Wow.
And I stuck with that like for my entire last year of high school because during that time, what I was telling myself is you're going to be the perfect person to go into college after you get done with all of this running. And it's just, it's really weird stuff like that. I still find myself doing it. Like I went back to drinking and it hasn't actually been very successful lately, but I'm trying my best. But yeah, like I'll kind of like go a little crazy or something one weekend and I'll like be drinking like every day, like over drinking, binge drinking and stuff like that, and then I'll wake up from it the next week and be like, I need to get my life back together, and so I'll create this new routine for myself that I'll stick with for a while.
Yeah.
Until I forget to do something one day and then it's back to the bottle.
Yeah.
And it's just basically like a weird, like, I don't know. It's weird because, like, I know this stuff about myself, but I can't break the cycle.
Right.
Well,
but again, I mean, if you're striving for a level of control, cycles are a real good way to assert control over your life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of those things that you can rely on. You can rely on a downward spiral in a lot of ways. And so, especially if you're a person with an addictive personality, which honestly, I think addictive personality comes from a number of factors. I mean, some of it's chromosomes and genetics, and some of it is mindset. That's why those two things are so very important, because there are people who can have two drinks and then go home, and then there's people who have to have all of the drinks.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of room in between there.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be hard to know where you're at any given moment. Or, you know, am I a person who's having a serious problem? Or am I a person with alcohol? Or am I a person who's having a serious problem and is using alcohol to avoid that problem?
Yeah, and I honestly think, because I've met a lot of people who have had issues with alcohol, and I'm glad that so many of them have been, like, pretty open about it and stuff, because it makes you feel like, you know, I'm not, like, that drunk, like, on the sidewalk, you know? Like, there's a lot of people out there, like, who I think basically self-medicate in that kind of way.
Sure.
And a lot of the time, like, I think it's almost like an escape or something.
Yeah, definitely. People need boxes to put their shit in. They just do. And everybody's got all this emotional baggage. Every single person on this planet. It's like you talking about hearing that song and just bawling your eyes out. I mean, there are people who go in for a massage who have never had a massage before, and it's like the floodgates open and they don't know why, but they just start weeping deeply.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's because they've never been touched before, or maybe it's because there was something inside them that just needed to be loosened. They're so used to being tense that suddenly they're not. And it's like, oh, I didn't know there was another option. But it's like when you hear that song that you're like, well, I'm not a depressed person, but then I heard this song and it was almost like this valve got turned and suddenly I'm feeling all these things that I was pushing down for all of this time, and now they're out. And so you've spent all of this time keeping things in check where they are, but then once you've seen how not to do that, it's like you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
But then how do you put the genie back in the bottle?
It's hard.
You don't. You go get a different bottle. And then you pour some smiles on your brain and hope that it helps you set that screaming voice that tells you that you're not good enough aside for a couple of minutes, because that voice is you.
And that's one of the things about that I've noticed about American society in general, is I think that there's just such a... there's so much demand for people to just push things down and be okay and smile through life. And,
yeah,
you know, like, you're going to get through this day. Like, don't be sad about that. And there's so many self-help things out there. Like, so many people constantly posting on Facebook about how they figured everything out and every day is the greatest day ever.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can't be like that all the time. It's, people have more than one emotion. You can't just be happy all the time.
Yeah.
So I almost think, like, alcohol especially is a real great drug for that type of society.
Yeah.
Because for a second you can actually let things out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's the massage. It's the sad song. It allows you to feel the things that you have been trying not to. It kind of massages those feelings out of you. And it can do other things too. It can do some pretty awful things as well. You can feel some things that aren't there. You can, because you're impaired, so your judgment is impaired. And so it's a real catch 22, because it's like the junkie who figures out, well, you know, I can do this much heroin and a Xanax, but not also a Valium, because that could kill me. You know, that person who figures out their personal body chemistry dosage to make everything okay without being dangerous. People don't usually get that right for very long. And so alcohol is another one of those things. I mean, technically, it's kind of a poison. You're sort of fucking yourself up.
Yeah. And to me, it's almost like I would poison my emotions too. Like, I know it probably happens to a lot of other people, but I used to just like inexplicably get really angry when I was drunk. Like back when I was really, really bad. And this obviously like put so many people who were really close to me like through a lot of like messed up shit. Like,
yeah.
Will spent so many nights like trying to take care of me and everything when I was like in that state. But looking back on it now, it's like I almost feel like that was another like sort of repressed emotion. And it wasn't really anger that I was feeling, but more fear.
Yeah.
Because circling back to my whole perfectionism thing, I'm actually really terrified of most people. Like, I'm just terrified of humans in general. I just feel like they're always out there and they're like going to put me down and stuff like that. Like, even the smallest, stupidest thing. I remember I was at a bar a month or so ago, and I was like walking out of the bathroom and I almost ran into this guy because like he was like going down the hallway or something, and I just said sorry, and the guy was all like, don't ever say sorry, you don't need to say sorry for something like that, no, and like that put me like in this weird mood for the rest of the entire night where I couldn't even like talk to people anymore,
because
I was just like, I did something really bad. And it's just stuff like that that I expect to encounter all the time. So I do have a lot of like, I've realized recently that I do tend to have a lot of like very repressed fear, because I don't like to seem like I'm scared of everything. I don't think anyone does.
Right.
But, you know, it's just the reality of it. And it's something like, you know, at least if you figure out that that's really how you're feeling, you can at least take steps to try to not feel that way anymore.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's another thing with me.
Were you ever, like bullied or anything as a kid?
I actually remember, for some reason, like, recently, I had all these memories come back of, like, when I was, like, a really little kid in elementary school, and the first time I ever remember being bullied. An important little tidbit for the story, by the way, is I went to school, and I was, like, a year younger than everyone in my class, and it wasn't like I was some advanced child or anything. It was just that I was born at the very end of the year. So
yeah,
it, the timing just didn't really work out socially for me. So I went to school, for preschool. I went when I was like 3 years old, and I was still, at that time in my life, like my favorite things ever were Winnie the Pooh and Barney. And I was a 3 year old.
Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
So I remember I had this like Barney backpack. It was just shaped like Barney. And like I brought it to my first day of school and I was like so excited about it and stuff. But all these other kids who were like a year older than me or something, I guess when you're four, you don't watch Barney anymore and it's something dumb. So they all, they all started making fun of me and I never wore that backpack again. Funny story though, my mom apparently was digging through a bunch of old stuff to donate and she found it and she was like, do you want this back? And I was like, heck yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I now will wear it around everywhere.
Exactly.
Screw
loud
those kids.
And proud.
But yeah, it was like a lot of stuff like that. I got bullied a lot, mainly just because I was younger and not at the same social level as a lot of other people. Like, when I went to middle school and a bunch of my girlfriends were starting to get into guys and dating and stuff like that, I was still like, oh, I want to play Pokemon all the time and, like, read Harry Potter and stuff like that. And everyone was already past that, like, point. So it was kind of, like, a combination of being bullied and also just being, like, isolated. Like, you know, people would have sleepovers and stuff that I wouldn't be invited to because it's like, oh, well, she's just going to want to, like, talk about Harry Potter or something and not boys and stuff like that.
Well, it's funny that you mention, you know, it being like a social awkwardness, because the thing about that that is actually more true is that you had not yet learned to be as socially awkward as the other kids, because when you're becoming a teenager, especially, that is the hardest time in the world to ever admit you like anything, because you're just going to be judged.
Yeah, and everyone's anything so you like. Ridiculously cynical at that age. Like,
sure, because like everybody's afraid. Because everyone is afraid that they're a fraud, and that they're just a moment away from being found out for being a fraud, because you are. You're trying to present this version of yourself. You're trying to make a version of yourself out of everything that you've seen. You're trying to figure out, what's my identity? And it's like, well, there's these six identities in the catalog. So I'm going to try one on and see how it fits. And I can't be wrong. And I think that that might be a direct line from where you were as a little kid. You know, you're drinking too much and running too much and dieting too much is all a direct result of being told your backpack sucks.
Yeah, and that's the weirdest thing, is it's only been just recently that I've kind of, like, drawn all the way back to just, like, being
weird?
Teased for my Barney backpack.
Yeah.
Because I do remember the last time I went to go visit my parents, they had just been putting, like, a bunch of old home movies from the 90s, from, like, video cassettes onto DVDs or something like that. So they decided to play a bunch of them while we were all back there for Christmas. And I remember seeing, like, me as a little kid. I was actually, like, this really outgoing, like, super social, like, leader of a kid, like, always jumping around and wanting to put on plays for people and, like, do all these performances and stuff. And then it almost seems like as soon as I went to school and started getting teased and realizing or thinking in my own mind that I wasn't good enough for, like, all of the other kids there, that was when, like, I started to kind of withdraw into myself and I became way more introverted and kind of what I'm like now.
Here you are just being you, and criticism could come at any moment from anywhere. So best to prepare for it.
Yeah.
And when you're constantly thinking about where the criticism is going to come from, you start getting really creative with what you don't like about yourself and what you're worried about within yourself.
Yeah. I remember the second time that happened, though, was actually when I went to college, because I was extremely excited to get off island, as I had been talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And I was excited to begin this new life in a bigger place where I could do more things and there'd be more opportunities. And I thought, like, I was more than intellectually ready for college, but I was nowhere near socially ready for college. I didn't know anything about pop culture. I came there and I was basically this awkward person in conversations all the time. And that was really where the drinking started, because obviously it puts you more at ease in social situations.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel like you're not as shitty of a person as you think you have been.
Yeah.
I started realizing, oh, there's this magic juice and where can I get more of that?
Yeah.
But then, yeah, it definitely turned into something bad pretty quick.
Yeah, I discovered alcohol fixing social situations way late, because I had just decided I didn't like drinking when I was younger. When I was thoroughly suicidal, I did everything because I thought you know, that's the way to go, is to, you know, overdose or drink too much or something. That's the way to do it, because then it's painless or whatever, and, you know, the cowardice is just amplified at that point. And so I thought, that's the way to go. I'm going to just do a bunch of drugs, and if I don't die, I'll probably have a lot of fun. And so to me, it seemed like a good trade-off. But I didn't go to parties. I just did drugs by myself. I just drank by myself, 'cause I had severe social anxiety. I didn't want to go anywhere. But then, so I didn't have any of the fun shit that comes along with doing drugs or drinking, really.
Yeah.
So I got tired of it, and I just didn't do it anymore. I got it all out of the way before I turned 21. And then I turned 21, and I opened a bottle of champagne, because I could buy it, and I drank champagne and played with Legos. And that's what I did. And then I didn't drink after that, because I didn't care for it. It just wasn't my thing. And I learned later a couple of things. I learned that I was in a small town where people just like to drink really shitty things. And I apparently am a booze snob. Because apparently I do like beer. But, you know, like Russian Imperial Stouts and stuff like that. Like, I like those. I don't like Milwaukee's Best or Natural Ice or 40s of King Cobra. Like, it's just not what I'm into. And I discovered this because I played in a band for years and years and years. I'd play in bars, and I would see people drinking, but I didn't want to drink because I was there to work. So it was like, you know, I have to be sharp, because, again, I was really worried that if I wasn't the best drummer anybody had seen, I was going to get my ass kicked or something. Yeah. You know, I mean, it was a punk rock show. It could have happened.
You never know.
So I was worried about that. And that was the one thing I ever wanted to be good at. Like, I'd never cared about anything else, but I wanted to be a good drummer. And so I didn't drink. I drank coffee. I was just pounding black coffee like a maniac. And I discovered years later that if I had, like, one glass of wine around people, they didn't scare me. And I could talk to them. And it was a revelation. I mean, it was a complete revelation. Being able to go somewhere without having to justify my personal existence and reason for being there was brand new. And I didn't get that until I was like 30. And that was just like 10 years ago. So it's like, it more or less, I mean, don't get me wrong, there was a period there where I was figuring it out.
Yeah. Where
it got a little excessive. Like, well, if it makes it good here, it must make things great everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and while Christmas was great with the family, and going to Thanksgiving was good with the family, all that was great, and, you know, yeah, things were better, and, you're great, you know, you're a good guy, love your tattoos and your truck. It was not advisable for me to go that all in. So I had to figure out what I was going to do. I had to make a decision to realize whether or not I was capable of recalibrating. Because alcoholism runs in my family.
Mm-hmm.
And I know where I'm at with addiction things, too. I smoked cigarettes forever and ever and ever, and quitting cigarettes after 17 years was like 100 times harder than quitting drugs.
Yeah.
It was impossible. So when I did that, I was acutely aware of what addiction and withdrawal feels like.
Yeah.
And so it just made me nervous for the longest time, alcohol. Like, because I liked it, for one, and when I like something, I go all in. And for two, it runs in my family that it's dangerous for people.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I don't know if that hit me or not, because sometimes alcoholism skips, sometimes it don't. I honestly, to this day, still don't know if I have alcoholism in me.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't know. And I still drink. And once in a while, I think about it. And whenever I start thinking about it, I stop drinking.
Yeah.
To see if I can. to see if my hands start shaking or something. Because it makes me nervous. It still makes me nervous.
That's interesting that you say that, because alcoholism actually runs in my family, too. Mainly on my dad's side. But it's, like, one of those things that we just don't talk about. The word alcoholism, it's like, don't speak that word. Dad just likes to have a good time. I remember when I stopped drinking for 2 years, and I first started getting back into it, I was actually terrified to just take that first drink, because I was like, this is going to set me down a slippery slope. And it kind of actually has again, but it's not as bad as it used to be. So I kind of think, though, that that's like a real like trap for myself, is constantly saying like, well, it's not as bad as it used to be. So,
right.
Unlike what you were saying, I can't like really impose rules on myself as far as like drinking goes and follow them. When I first started drinking, and I was like, okay, you're only going to have 2 drinks whenever you're out. And 2 drinks turned into 3, 3 turned into 4, 4 turns into 6. And that's just the way that it goes. And I find myself even like a few weeks ago, I had to finish up a band poster for one of our upcoming shows. And I was like kind of on a time crunch for it. I'd had like a really busy week with this other art exhibit that I was going to be in and stuff like that. We had like a bunch of whiskey at home. And so I was kind of like, oh, well, to get myself started, I guess I'll like just take a little half shot and, you know, it'll get me going. Yeah. Suddenly I'd had like 4 shots and I was like bending over the paper, just like trying desperately to not mess up. I should not, I don't know. It's like, I'll have a job to do and it'll be something that's legitimately important to me, like doing art, but somehow alcohol always trumps all of that.
Do you think it's the stress?
I think that that's definitely a part of it. My job isn't ideal, for my lifestyle. So a lot of the time I'll come back home from work and I'm like, the only thing that I want right now is like a drink. And, that usually ends up spiraling into a bad night. So
there are all of these other factors that you don't really have control over. It's like, you know, I mean, you've got a job, you've got responsibilities, you've got pets, you've got a partner, you've got your desires versus your needs. And so of course there's going to be that place where your needs are getting in the way of your desires.
Yeah.
And that's hard to live with for any person. And so, I mean, I kind of get that, because I have the same thing where when things are particularly tough, especially with alcohol, it's funny that we're having this conversation, because the funny thing about alcohol to me is that it's great for a celebration when something goes right, but it's great to drown your sorrows when something goes wrong. So it's kind of always there as this option, just sitting there ready to make you feel a little more relaxed about everywhere where you're at. And suddenly you still have your problems, but they're over there.
That's how I feel every time I come home from work and take that first drink at the end of the day. Yeah. It's like, well, now I don't have to think about that horrible day that I just had. Like,
it's seductive.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely terrifying.
And the weirdest thing, though, was when I first decided that I was going to stop drinking, I obviously did a lot of reading about alcoholism and learning about people who are, I guess they call them high-functioning alcoholics.
Yeah.
Really hit home to me, because...
You're in Denver.
It's like, I just remember the way that I used to think about it was like, well, I can still act okay, even if I've had all of these drinks, and as long as no one knows, then that's fine. And the number of times I would go into work so hungover, like, that I would just be sitting in the bathroom for, like, 30 minutes at the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
But somehow, like, I'm sure people probably noticed, but they won't say anything about it. And as long as no one's going to say anything about it, you still think that you're doing just fine.
Yeah.
And you think that you can continue this lifestyle.
yeah.
But in reality, you can't keep doing that. Like, it'll wear you down.
Yeah, totally. Like, Denver is one of those cities where it's very easy to be an alcoholic here.
Yeah,
it's so easy. People think of Colorado as the weed place, but if you spend any length of time here, you start to recognize no, it's still just drinking.
Yeah, it's like I remember when I was first applying for jobs, the number of places that were like, oh, we've got like this, we just have beers. We have all these craft beers.
Yeah.
Like, Johnny's been brewing his own beers in his garage. You just bring some in every Tuesday.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's breweries everywhere. At one of my last jobs, I mean, there was beer at work. And as long as you didn't drink too much, it was there. At work. I work in tech. Like, we shouldn't be drinking. So it's, I totally get it. But it is one of those things where, you know, and again, it's a good thing that I have a disclaimer that I'm not any kind of real therapist. Because my perspective on this has become one that I think is probably flawed and probably wrong. But I think that there is a level where even if you've got some of that in you, you know, some of those teeth that really want to dig into that part of your brain where you're not necessarily in control, I think that there is a way to learn how to coexist with that and to be able to truly be a high functioning alcoholic.
Yeah.
A person who can have a few drinks, and will yourself to stop. And I mean, let's face it, if you're a person who is wired to have, alcoholism, you're going to feel that pull. You're going to feel those teeth getting into you. The tough thing about all of that is that, for one, willpower is hard anyway, and it's even harder when suddenly you're loose and happy. But I think that there's probably, for some people, there's probably a way to manage that the same way you can manage your symptoms of depression and anxiety. They don't go away. They come with you. They stay with you. I mean, all of the alcohol literature tells you that too, that once you're an alcoholic, you're just an alcoholic. You're never a former alcoholic.
That's the thing though, is I don't like that way of thinking.
Yeah.
I think that AA and the whole just sobriety forever does work for a lot of people.
Sure.
And I think that if you're like, you know, really, really down and out, then that's a really good answer.
Yeah.
But for me, I've always been kind of like one of those people who's like sees a problem and I'm like, I want the real solution to this, though.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to just stay away from the thing that's scaring me.
Right.
I want to face it and I want to conquer it.
Conquer it. Yeah.
But
totally.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know.
That's what I'm doing with my bipolar disorder. I should probably be on a medication, but you know what? There's got to be another way.
Yeah.
So yeah, I find that fascinating. Do you think that the depression and anxiety fed the alcohol issue, or do you think the alcohol issue fed the depression issue?
Well, I think they kind of feed each other, honestly, because I would start drinking because I'd, like, right out of college, I had a call center job, and that, like, I'm not, I don't like talking to people just, like, in general, so
no
that was, like, the worst freaking, like, job for me to have ever. And that
you don't
just,
like people. You should be in customer service.
Like, yeah. This seems perfect for me. Let's go. So that job gave me a lot of anxiety, like all day long. And that amount of anxiety just like beating you down all day, like that made me want to start drinking at the end of the day. But then if I drank too much, then it would make me more anxious and throw me in a depression, after, you know, going through like this nasty bender or something.
Yeah.
And I would just like not leave bed for days. I would take work off because I just couldn't even like bear existing being myself at all.
Yeah.
I just kind of like wanted to basically just like sink into the bed sheets and like never come back out. So I think that it's actually more like, I guess anxiety causes me to drink. And then after drinking, I get thrown into depression. But there's like also definitely a lot of anxiety that comes with that too. And thinking, what did I do last night? I don't remember any of it.
Yeah.
Like what kind of horrible shenanigans did I get myself into again?
Right.
And how many people did I cut out of my life this time? Which is another hard thing. It's like when you don't have very many friends to begin with, you make close connections to people and then you get drunk and push them all away.
Yeah.
So that's been like another theme in my life, my adult life. But
yeah. So how is Will at recognizing where you are at any given moment?
He doesn't really point things out is the thing, because I think that he realizes at this point that I realize that I'm not doing the best thing for myself either. And after all of these years, especially when I finally put my foot down and decided to stop drinking for 2 years, I did that on my own. I mean, he could have like spent night after night after night telling me that I needed to stop and I wouldn't have listened to him. So I think it's kind of one of those mutual understanding things where he realizes that if I don't decide that I need to help myself, then there's no point in even pestering me about it and I'm just going to get mad. And it's the same thing the other way around too, because Will was actually off antidepressants for the longest time. And I told him, like, I think that you should get back on them, but he wouldn't like take that step or anything until he himself finally decided that it was time for him to get back on antidepressants. Yeah. So if he was to stop again, I would probably just kind of, you know, try to care for him the best way that I can, but not pester him into doing something until he's ready to do it.
Right. I mean, you guys have pretty much made your decision to, you know, ride or die.
Yeah.
Like, you're really
kind of actually helps that we both have experienced a lot of depression. I mean, him definitely more so than I, but we both have like a lot of mental issues going on. So, you know, if he wants to lay in bed all day, or if he needs to do that because that's what his brain is telling him to do,
yeah,
then I have to just let him do it. And I don't get mad about any of that kind of stuff. He sees me get like pissed drunk some night. It's more of just a, let's make sure she doesn't hurt herself kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we'll put her to bed and she'll probably change her mind about all of this tomorrow. And
I mean, in some ways that's actually probably the most you could hope for from a partnership with another person is that kind of trust that, you know, I don't necessarily know if you know what you're doing right now, but I'm going to trust you enough to just be here while you figure it out.
And that I feel like is one of the most important things when you're, you know, when you have any sort of relationship with someone who has depression or anxiety or any kind of mental issues.
Yeah.
Is just like you just being there means so much more than like, you know, saying all these meaningless words or anything to them.
Yeah.
Like I personally, for me, like I would rather just have someone be there when I'm going through my worst than try to tell me what I need to do or try to explain to me why I'm feeling like that.
Yeah. You know what I don't like? And I know this is going to sound horrible, but I don't like hearing, I'm so sorry you're going through this or anything like that. I actually respond a lot better when someone is just seeing what I'm going through and saying, you know, I hear you. I see you. I believe you.
Yeah.
You know, those things. Like, I'd much rather hear that because I don't know why I have such a visceral reaction to the I'm sorry. I think mostly because it triggers a number of things, especially the center of your brain that feels like you're a problem for mm-hmm. other people. And it's almost like when someone's apologizing for, like, I'm sorry you feel that way, it's almost like they're saying, you were weirding me out right now, and I don't know how to help you.
And it's almost a roundabout way of them telling you to stop when yeah. you can't really stop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It does kind of feel that way. And, you know, you can start beating yourself up about it, like, fuck, this person I care about, I just made them sad because I'm sad.
Yeah.
Instead of really, I mean, sometimes it's innocent. I'm certain of it. You know, people don't know how to process what you're going through because they don't know what it feels like to wake up in the morning and have all of the color stripped out of the world and things that brought you joy now bring you nothing. You know, there's just this great void where once you felt something. Yeah. And, you know, it would almost be like telling someone, I want you to smash your hand with a hammer until all of your fingers are broken. Now, imagine you're not going to feel any of that until tomorrow. And that's kind of what it's like sometimes.
Yeah.
Because it's just this emotionless void where there's nothing but darkness. And, you know, there is sadness, but depression and sadness are so different.
Oh, yeah, that's so true.
So to take those things and wrap them up into a person who is now also in a relationship with another person who's experiencing those same things, it can always go one of several ways. The two most common being there's a high level of toxicity, or two people really understand each other and they do great because they understand each other. And from everything that I've ever observed, I think that's where you guys are.
Yeah. I kind of feel the same way. I feel like I got really lucky to meet someone like Will who, there's just a mutual understanding. There just always has been. It's
yeah.
like something that we haven't even really had to try with. But yeah. What you said though about, you know, just acknowledging that someone feels pain when they're going through something really hard is the most important thing, instead of, like, you know, trying to say that you're sorry or anything like that.
Or trying to take it away.
Yeah, or at least, like, you know, from my own perspective, like, to circle back on, like, my childhood and everything, when I first started, you know, kind of isolating myself and sitting in my room and being really depressed all the time, my parents didn't really understand it, and they didn't really care to. And it was like, I got a lot of like, why are you like this? Why are you acting like this? Like, why?
Yeah.
And that almost is like one of the worst things you can say to someone who's going through depression or
yeah.
anything of that nature, because they're like, I don't know why.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that I wasn't like this. Like, I don't know why I'm acting like this, but I yeah. can't explain it to you. And, you know, you don't really even, like, have, I at least didn't have, like, any sort of way of asking for help, because I didn't know what was going on with me either.
Yeah.
There was never, like, a time in my life where anyone even suggested that I take any sort of, like, antidepressants. Actually, until I met Will, and I tried antidepressants for a while, and then I got on these, like, other pills that were, it was like a mood stabilizer
yeah.
after they diagnosed me with bipolar disorder that
sure.
I didn't have, which actually worked real well for me. But then I've never been very good at taking pills, so I kind of stopped taking them and it's never renewed my prescription.
Yeah.
But I also kind of don't think that I really need that. Or personally, like, I don't really feel like it was really benefiting me in such a great way that, like, I needed to continue doing it.
Yeah.
So now I just self-medicate.
Well, it seems like you're doing great.
Yeah. I try at least.
Yeah, it's a real process to try and figure those things out and to try and understand what your body is telling you. And my whole situation with taking pills and things like that was, you know, the thing I've said over and over again is that I had this worry that if I was ever on a desert island without my medication, would my brain be the thing that was going to kill me?
An interesting thing to think about.
So I just obsessed over that over and over again. But the truth is there was another layer to all of this. I went through a series of cocktails of medication, some of which actually worked. That said, when they worked, I feel like currently my emotions, for highs and lows, operate at probably a 20 instead of a 10. Because I will go crazy high, to the point where I will literally feel like the inside of my body is going to burst. Literally feel that way. And I cannot even conjure a whisper of those feelings right now. Like, if I were to think about, you know, stubbing my toe or hurting my hand, I can kind of conjure those feelings. If I remember a pet dying or, you know, my grandmother in hospice or things like that, I can touch that sadness. But I can't recall the low lows where, you know, there's nothing in the universe that can bring me joy, where everything is terrible. But it's so terrible to the point where it's crippling. It's hard to move. Your body is heavy. You can barely move yourself around. And so I operate in those, somewhere in between those 20s most of the time. Mm-hmm. And then once in a while, I get to go way up and then way down. And when I was on the medication that was doing what it was supposed to, I was pretty much at a constant 8. Now, have you ever gone running and couldn't quite get a deep breath?
Yeah.
It was like that, but with feelings.
Jeez.
Yeah, and so that scared the hell out of me.
I mean, that almost sounds like you'd just be sitting on the edge of your seat, like, all day long.
Yeah, kind of waiting to, like, I can't explain it any other way, and it's so hard to explain, but it's like I could feel an invisible force field at the edge of my emotions, where I knew I could feel more out there. Like, I could feel the limiter on me. And when I stopped taking the medication, I got my high highs back, and I got my low lows back. Bipolar 1 is the best one to have, if you're going to have it. Because those high highs are amazing. And the low lows are very crippling. But like we were talking about before, with self-medicating, I almost think you can start to get to know yourself to the point where, yeah, I know that I'm going to get hit with suicidal thoughts, but they're just not tangible anymore. They're just not realistic. They still show up. They're still there. But, you know, it's like I could kill myself or I could tame unicorns.
Yeah.
I mean, they're both just as realistic. They both make me feel the same amount of nothing when I think about them now. I have suicidal thoughts all the time, almost every day, but they don't mean anything. You know, it would be like just the most random shit that passes through your head, like, who voiced the gingerbread guy in Shrek? Oh, you could jump off a bridge.
Yeah.
You know, those two things. And then oh, muffins. You know, like...
yeah. Because it almost sounds like because you've lived with them for so long that it's almost like they've just always been a part of your life, and so they're there.
Sure.
They exist, but you can, you know, move past them at this point.
I've learned how to coexist with it. It's just, you know, well, if I'm going to have this, how am I going to have this? And I think that you can do that with most things. There's some things you can't. Like, you know, obviously you can't outsmart your diabetes.
Yeah. That'd be a little hard.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've lived with it for so long.
Yeah. And there are a number of people like with schizophrenia or Alzheimer's or even other forms of bipolar or depression or addiction issues or any of those things who maybe they've tried figuring these things out. And it's better for them to not do whatever it is. It's better for them to hit the medication. It's better for them to just say, you know what? I know myself well enough that it doesn't bother me to not drink.
Yeah. Like,
okay, I'm done. Or it doesn't bother me to say, yeah, I know weed's not addictive, but it makes me weird. And then, you know, I start wanting to do other things. Who knows? You know, the people that... I know a couple of people who had zero problems with alcohol at all, but they had serious problems with other things. Hmm. And so they'd be like, yeah, the problem is my judgment would get impaired when I was drinking, and I'd want to go get Coke. And then it's like, yeah, okay. They're like, yeah, so I didn't have a problem with drinking, but I had a real problem with Coke, so jeez, I had to quit drinking to get rid of my Coke problem. It's like, well, all right, yeah. I mean, if you know that about you and you're willing to do it, right on. Do what works. I'm completely not a moralist in that sense.
Yeah.
Because I think that people got to do what works. And you got to make some decisions. Honestly, it's not always in your best interest to make decisions that are about your safety.
Yeah, that's true. I think that everyone kind of figures out what works best for them. And, you know, I mean... outside people, like, really aren't the ones to tell them, like, what they should and should not be doing.
Yeah. So, like, in your case...
I was actually going to kind of circle back to that, but I've actually noticed, like, the second time around with drinking, I have this little awareness in the back of my head where I'm like, you really, like, you can drink now, but, like, don't completely overdo it where you've been drunk for like 3 days and like you don't know what's been going on or
because you know you have that in you.
Yeah, because I know that I can do that. I've done it before. Like I've fallen down that like rabbit hole. And I don't really want to go there again. And although like I mean there have been nights like I mentioned before, like the second time around where I just kind of forget and I completely abuse alcohol to the point where it's like, oh, I wake up and I'm like, oh wow, I almost finished that 750. there you go. It's Wednesday. I will get to actual like points like when I'm still coherent enough where I'm kind of like I'll go and reach for like my next shot and then I'll be like, but why though? Like I can already like barely.
Yeah.
Like, I can't, like, my vision's, like, starting to blur and stuff. Like, just put it down and don't have any more for the rest of the night because whether you have more to drink or not, you're just going to end up passing out in bed anyways and waking up the next day. And you'll either feel worse for taking more shots now or you won't feel as bad if you just stop at this point.
Yeah.
So I have noticed, like, that's starting to, like, kind of pop up in my life more often. So I think that there's hope for the future. I'm not exactly like, I don't feel like I'm ever going to reach some point where I'm like, oh, I've seen the light and like suddenly my life is great. Like I always thought that I would, you know, with this perfect version of myself. And
yeah.
Stuff.
Think you will.
Yeah. But I think like now I've come to realize that life is much more of like, it's always a growing experience and you're just like, you can make yourself better, but there's no goal to reach for.
There's only better.
Yeah.
There's not done.
Like for me, there is no perfect Katie. Like this is some myth that I crafted for myself when I was like some lonely kid in high school who just wanted friends and thought that I could control my life in such a way where I could make myself better and then the friends would come.
Yeah.
It's just dumb to think that way.
Well, you know, with everything else, I mean, like your struggles with everything that you've gone through, the decision to start drinking again, and the decision to, move forward with not being so perfect all the time. Again, it's not a matter of being done. It's not a matter of having figured it out. It's just a matter of being better. So, I mean, you weren't so good at it before. Just be better.
Yeah.
And don't beat yourself up for not being perfect.
Yeah, because I remember I used to think about it too, like, in the past I was a bad person. But it wasn't that I was a bad person, it was just that I didn't know the things then that I do now. And, you know, I have a lot better, like, coping mechanisms now, or, like, you know, things that I can tell myself when I'm start noticing that I'm kind of, like, teetering on the edge of falling back into, like, real bad alcoholism.
Yeah. But it sounds like that's, a lot of that comes from places.
Yeah.
Do you ever engage in therapy or anything like that?
I've been to a number of therapists throughout my life, but none of them... I have a feeling I probably just wasn't going to the right people. Yeah. Like, the first therapist I ever went to was when I first started getting really depressed in high school, and my parents just sent me to this... She was, like, the nicest old lady, and she would, like, give me... Her whole method was basically like, oh, well, you should play with your dogs more and read this happy book and, like, you know, kind of stuff like, go out and take a walk and your depression will go away kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I got so frustrated. Like, I spent so... I remember, like, the last time I saw her, I think, like, I ended the entire session by just, like, screaming at her and telling her that she wasn't, like, doing what I needed to do, and I still feel really bad and I don't know why. So that was my first therapy experience, and I didn't want to go back after that for, like, the longest time. Until alcohol, like, I started abusing alcohol more and more in college, and I went to some more therapists and ended up being falsely diagnosed with bipolar disorder because I was lying about, like, I would never even say, like, I drank at all.
Yeah.
When clearly, like, all of my, like, outbursts and stuff were just from drinking. It wasn't from having bipolar disorder.
Because you don't want someone to tell you you have to stop doing that.
Yeah.
It's a lot easier to become, you know, the person who's got bipolar.
Yeah, and I didn't
the person
want...
who's got a drinking
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, it's like I didn't want to be like an alcoholic, you know. I didn't want to be one of those people.
Right.
But you know, okay, well, if I have like an actual like issues with my brain chemistry, then that's understandable, right? Like, I don't know. These are just like such stupid like ways of thinking that like you get into or something when you've been drinking for so long.
Totally.
It's like you just don't want people to know, and you'll go to like these crazy lengths so that they don't. So that happened, and then I like went on some antidepressants after that and mood stabilizers, which I didn't really notice, like, a huge effect, like, a positive effect in my life. I mostly just got stomach aches from those.
Yeah.
So, like I said, like, I kept taking them for a while, hoping that something would change, but then I forgot and just kind of stopped that.
Yeah.
And then, actually, about 2 or 3 years ago, I think, I went to the, like, last therapist that I saw. It was when I stopped drinking, because I wanted to, like, kind of talk through my alcohol problems and try to figure out, like, the origin of all of that, like, where does it come from? Why am I doing this to myself? But she ended up being very religious, I guess.
Yeah.
And she would do these, like, weird things, like, we would do these tapping things that were somehow supposed to, like, ease your anxiety, but I don't believe in that kind of...
yeah,
and she would always be like, oh, well, just smell these essential oils and you'll feel better. And I'm like, I do not feel better. Like, I just want to know, like, I want to talk through my past and figure out why I was drinking so much. I don't want to do tapping and smell things. Like, so after I realized that that wasn't going anywhere, I kind of stopped. And since then, I've just kind of spent a lot of time thinking about myself, I guess, being more introspective about everything.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, that's caused like a bunch of weird buried memories to pop up, like the thing about the Barney backpack and everything.
Yeah.
And I started kind of piecing together things like on my own. So I do think like therapy is really helpful for other people, especially if you can find the right therapist.
Sure.
But I don't think that it's really something for me, and I'm probably not going to go back.
I would say that one thing to be mindful of is you're getting easily the first three quarters of what really matters, which is getting introspective and starting to really think through these things. That is the most important part of all of the work you're ever going to do on yourself. The kicker is you're also a person who is going to beat yourself up. You're going to chase the wrong rabbits. You're going to not necessarily be completely objective. And you're not going to think of things that you don't already know.
Yeah.
So it's good to once in a while get perspective from elsewhere, whether it's talking it through with other people or talking it through with a therapist, or getting ideas out of a book, out of a YouTube video, because the idea isn't even necessarily to have someone give you the magic bullet that's going to fix everything, or give you, this perfect platitude that suddenly all of the dominoes are going to fall and it's all going to make sense. Because really the reality of it all is when it comes to therapists, you just got to find somebody who makes sense to you. And that's hard enough as is. It's not necessary for everybody to go see a therapist. But it is necessary for you to sometimes check some of these things against another source. Not necessarily because you're not capable of figuring out and doing things on your own, because really, you have to be the person that figures it out. But really, it's more for getting the perspective from an outside for the one thing you might not have thought of.
Yeah.
Because another human being, whether it's in a book or a YouTube video or a friend or a therapist, getting those outside things, it's basically like laying a bunch of shit on a table and saying, does any of this make sense to you?
Yeah.
And then for you to go, oh, screwdriver. I wouldn't have thought to use that. But here we are. Okay. Right on. Hey, thanks for putting that screwdriver on the table. And they're like, fucked fino. All right, good for you.
That's an interesting thing. It's like I do that with art, but I can't do it with myself. Like, I'll make something, and I constantly think that everything that I make is the worst thing ever. So, like, I'll always have to find someone else, and I'll be like, does this look good? What should I change? Usually it's a will. And I do the same thing with my feelings, too. Like, I'll bounce ideas off of him about, like, what I think, if I'm doing something wrong, or like, am I drinking too much or something like that? But yeah, I see what you mean. Like, having a therapist there is definitely a great thing. Like, especially if you don't have a lot of other people in your life who you feel comfortable talking to about those kinds of things.
It's a rough thing to put on people, because the language of all of this is hard. Because if you've got a problem, you are a burden to the people in your life.
Yeah. They don't want to hear about it.
And yeah, you are. And that's a thing that no one tells you, because they're afraid of hurting you when you're already hurting. But the problem is we've been raised with this dialogue being wired into us wrong from jump, when really, your wiring's a little fucked up for one reason or another. Maybe you were born that way. Maybe it was triggered. Maybe you got a bad massage, or you got a, you know, you listened to a Cure song from 1978. You know, who knows? Who knows where it comes from? None of that really matters. What matters is we're here now. You're a little weird, and that's all right. You're a problem to people sometimes. That's also all right. It's a fact of all of this and how it works. And once we start recognizing how to talk to each other in honest, direct language without hurting people with that language, you know, because there's a big difference between, I think something's off right now, but okay, and you're fucked up. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a great big difference between those things. And yeah. I think that you can tell somebody, yeah, I think you got something going on right now and I don't know how to help.
Yeah.
So good luck. And I love you. And I don't know how to be helpful for that. But if you want to see a movie, we can do that. Or, I'm uncomfortable with emotions, so if we could not talk about this, that would be great. You know, it's a number of things. And
yeah.
It sounds like at least you've got Will.
Yeah. I'm sure he probably gets tired of it sometimes.
Of course. But also, that's okay. It's okay to get tired of the people you love once in a while.
Yeah.
It's all good. All of these things are good.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like you've got a lot of self-awareness about this. You've done a lot of thinking about these things.
Gosh,
and it
I've
sounds like you know yourself pretty well, which
is
probably why
Googling
you don't like
stuff
yourself
too.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Because you've spent so much time with yourself. You spend enough time with anybody, you're going to find things about them you don't like.
Yeah.
And you've spent your whole life with you.
That is true.
So there you go. But I think you're great.
Aw.
A lot of people think you're great.
I guess I'm all right sometimes.
Thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh man, am I the only person who learned a bunch of things about Saipan on this episode? Or did you not know any of that either? I think that's fantastic. I looked up a lot of things, and in the process, I found out that if you want to help the devastation in Saipan right now, you can go to greatnonprofits.org. And choose from a list of various nonprofits and see which one best suits your needs as far as being able to help goes. Every little bit helps. That's all I got this week, everybody. If you want to find Katie, you can go to televisiongeneration.com. You can find them everywhere you can find music. And you can also find Static Interstate Designs on the Facebook and the Instagram. And as always, don't kill yourself out there.